Greetings and welcome to the Dividing Line, folks. I'm in the middle of downloading PDFs. Sorry. It's just, I'm chasing stuff through. I enjoy doing this. Wish I had more time to do this. Some of us like doing this kind of stuff, but I'm chasing all sorts of references in regards to forms of determinism and the Essenes and the Qumran community, which is how you pronounce it. Just arrived in the mail, we have The Myth of Pelagianism. We have Culture and Philosophy in the Age of Plotinus. This one that came from St. Louis University Library, actually. This come yesterday or day before yesterday? Because I brought it home. Yesterday? Okay. This is Manny and Manichaeism by Geo Wittengren. Translation by Charles Kessler, revised by the author. I was sitting up till way too late last night with this one. I was just listening to Leighton Flowers. I missed this, and I know exactly why I missed it. I missed this when I first listened to it because there is a dog at the corner of, remember Camino that goes out to 43rd? Right at the corner there, there's a real nice Mormon lady and her husband. I'm not sure if he's, I assume he's Mormon too, but I've only met her. And their dog is named Raider. And so whenever Raider's out in the lawn, then I either stop my bike or stop my run or whatever and go over. And I've actually gone to Target and bought Raider Christmas goodies in the past, you know. So Raider started barking at me as I was running past while listening to the Leighton Flowers Ken Wilson thing. And it was right at this point. That's why I missed this. Whole world did not need to know that, but it knows it now. Point is, just overwhelmed with the amount of different directions and material that you can go with in dealing with these assertions. So I was right in the middle of downloading that PDF, and I have no idea where it went. I hate when that happens. Download PDF, okay, and okay, you download it. Where'd it go? Is what I want to know. But that's okay. I'll find it eventually somewhere. On, you know, it could end up in Dropbox, and so it's in the cloud someplace. I don't know. Anyways, welcome to the program. Obviously, I was working hard on getting clips set up from the interview, and I've mentioned that I am in contact with a few other people, and there is one young man who, and I'm going to try to say his name. His name is Vietnamese, Thuen Dinh Tran. Thuen Dinh Tran, I think, is his name. I've lost track of how many images he has sent me from books. He is focused in one particular area, the issue of baptism in the early church prior to Augustine, and the concept of faith as a gift from God. And he has provided numerous citations, blowing major league holes through Ken Wilson's claims in regards to baptism and Augustine and the things that we've already played on the program and that are key to the whole theory that has been put forward. There was one. Let me see if I can scroll back to it here. There is a, I have these, I have all of these in my, I could pull them up in accordance here. There's a whole set. What is it entitled? The Ancient Christian Writers Commentary. Basically you can, and I have all of it in accordance. You can look up texts and these editors will provide, you know, obviously it's not exhaustive. It couldn't be exhaustive, but representative samples and commentary from various early church writers. And one of those individuals, which we spent way too much money getting, but I'm glad to have it because it's going to be useful in all sorts of things. All this is going to be useful in all sorts of things, to be honest with you. I mean, one of the neat things is all of these citations I'm running into about sola fide and the deadness of man in sin and faith as a gift of God, that I only knew marginally or did not have at all before. And one of the sources is Marius Victorinus, who, when Augustine read Aristotle and people related to him as a young person, he was reading this guy's translation in the Latin. So he is before Augustine. And in his comment, he was a well-known non-Christian orator, teacher, so on and so forth, who later in his life converted to Christianity and began writing commentaries. And one of the books that he wrote a commentary on was Galatians, and this one on Philippians. Be ready to suffer for his sake. It was therefore within his purpose. This is a commentary on Philippians 1:29. It was therefore within his purpose that he gave to us the gift of trusting in him. This was an incomparable gift. It is only by faith in him that we are blessed with so great a reward. We are to believe in such a way as to be ready to suffer for him. So notice, he gave to us the gift of trusting in him. What's Philippians 1:29? Philippians 1:29 is one of the texts that we Reformed people point to when it says, it has not been granted you to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. And so here you have someone prior to. And I want to bring up, I wish, to be honest with you, I do have Marius Victorinus's commentary on Galatians here. The one thing I wish the Kindle reader would allow you to do is to have more than one book up at a time, because you have to jump between books. Maybe that's something that's coming, or maybe they just don't want you to be able to do that. I don't know. But anyways, there's just so much stuff, and I want to acknowledge where a lot of the baptism stuff and stuff like that is coming from that source, and I believe that Twen is going to. I've encouraged him to be looking at a book. He's got that much material, and it'd be well worth doing. And so he is a Lutheran, a good. He still believes what Luther wrote in The Bondage of the Will. I like Lutherans like that. It's the really synergistic ones that give the Lutherans a bad name, or the liberals. He's neither a liberal, and he's a good guy. So what?
Oh, I was just going to pop in here real quick and point out to folks that, you know, some of these books that we've been getting here have got a price tag that is mind-boggling.
You would be the one that...
And I would like to point out that while the travel fund folks, you know, kind of, it's a little full right now. We're not traveling anywhere. We can't do that.
And I'm still hoping we'll get to
yes, indeed.
Empty it out by the end of the year.
But folks need to recognize that when they donate to those specific ones, we have to use those funds for that purpose.
Right.
We can't use them for anything else. So they're segregated out. But when you've been donating to the material resources list,
that's what allows us to do it.
First of all these books, any of those kind of books, this research, okay, all gets paid for out of that fund.
Yep.
Any special equipment that we have to get along the way or anything like that, that's a revolving fund and it's off budget. So given the fact that this is in my wheelhouse, really present tense in my brain right now,
right,
it's important to mention this. So when you've been donating to the MRL fund, you're making that possible for books with great big fat price tags to be acquired for this kind of research. So
yep.
I just wanted to mention that.
Well, thank you for doing what I never do. By the way, there's nothing on the screen, just in case you're not aware of that. So yes, that's how we can do all that kind of stuff. And someone certainly is going to write to you and go, yeah, well, you couldn't buy the dissertation. You had to send it to him, and now you're spending all this other stuff and other stuff. Well, no, because I will refute that. This is solid material. I already looked at this and went, this is bad. Okay. So I'm not going to, you know.
I have to say, just for the sake of clarification, it was not about the price tag so much
as, no, it wasn't.
As this is the process. It is customary that you do it this way. If you're going to come out and challenge somebody to debate or interact with your work, it's customary that you send them your work.
Provide it, yeah.
So that's what that was about.
Yeah. Okay, so I've got 47,000 things on the screen here. How I'm going to keep all of them straight, I have absolutely no earthly idea. But I will do my best, and we'll go from there. He's talking so loud we can still hear him. So I'm still hearing him through the glass. Someone called in, I guess. But before we get to all of that, I want to answer a question that was sent in by an old man. Well, I mean, an old friend who, like me, is becoming an old man. He is younger than I am, I think. I'm pretty sure. But that doesn't mean much anymore because a lot of people are. And I won't use his name because this is a question of, well, let's just put it this way. He says he's asked other people who I will not name either, and no one will give him a response. And I know why. This is a hot potato football issue type thing. But it's one that I've addressed many, many times and will address it again here. And basically he said, well, we have a new minister who insists upon using, he didn't say a TR, he said the majority text, but utilizing the non-critical text and hence preaching on the longer ending of Mark, the pericope adulterae, the woman taken adultery, and says this is the way that God has preserved his word. Now, fundamentally, I think that any group of elders needs to make a decision as to what stance they're going to be taking. And if a group of elders want to adopt a TR-only position or a majority text position, just be clear about it. Make sure people understand it. That's your responsibility as the shepherds of that congregation. The vast majority of elders will utilize the modern Greek text and SCL and UBS, whatever it might be. But in non-leadership positions, we'll allow for differences of opinion and utilizations. But most these days, because of our phones and because we have so many, hey, my phone just told me to watch me. No, seriously, it says, watch live now, Alpha and Omega Ministries, The Dividing Line, live. I'm like, I feel like saying, how can I? Because that would become an infinite loop. I've been subscribed for a long, long time. YouTube's just getting around to telling me these things now. So my phone is telling me to watch myself. So that could be strange. I think that each church just needs to be very clear. And I think a lot of churches are not clear about it at all and tend to leave it on the side. But because we all have our phones, that means there are people sitting there. They're using multiple different translations. And it is an extra step in sermon preparation to be looking at a wide variety of translations. Now, my suggestion on a practical level, by the way, just in passing at that point, is if you preach from NESB, ESV, Christian Standard Bible, the upcoming Legacy Standard Bible. In other words, if you preach from a Bible, a modern Bible that is based upon the modern eclectic text, NA26 onward. Then I would compare the New King James. You don't have to compare dozens of different translations. I would just make sure, take a quick glance at the New King James and see if maybe you're dealing with a text where there is a major textual difference between what you have in the modern eclectic text and what's in the TR. Basically, that's what you'll see when you look at the New King James. And if you use the New King James, do it in reverse. You don't have to spend a whole lot of time, but it is good to make sure that you do some checking there. Now, the problem here is that we live in a day where the textual transmission of the New Testament, in particular, there's not that much. There just isn't that much difference in the Old Testament. I think your elders should have a knowledge of what the Greek Septuagint is and how you're going to view it. But the Old Testament isn't generally where this stuff comes from. There's very, very, very few differences between the 1525 Blomberg, which the King James used, and the modern Hebrew text. So it's the New Testament where these issues come up. So you should be aware of where your preaching is coming from and the fact there are going to be people who are exposed to all these other perspectives. And in our day, the transmission of the text of the New Testament is under tremendous attack. And no matter how we try to hide from it, it's not been ever something I've tried to hide from, but a lot of people do, you have to address these issues as a pastor, as one who has a responsibility to refute the gainsayers, to use the King James terminology, refute those who contradict. And so we can't avoid these issues. And if you're in a situation where the eldership has determined that there can be variation amongst the elders on this issue, then you're going to get the trumpet's going to sound a different note, because you're not going to be able to say to the people, well, we believe that God has preserved the word in this way. Because now you're going to have multiple ways being presented as the mechanism. And I think, honestly, and we've gone over this over and over and over again, the only really consistent way, from a Reformed perspective, seeing that God is king over all that takes place in time, is not to do the dropkick, we're going to just grab hold of this one over here, because it looks good to us, and it came out of the Reformation, at least whatever form we've decided to use did, and therefore that's just the text. I think if you believe that whatsoever takes place in history does so at the predetermined counsel of God for his own glory and for his own purposes, then you need to look at all of church history. You need to look at what the church used in the 4th century and the 2nd century and the 7th century and the 12th century. And you can't ignore any of those things. And when you do that, I think you will be forced to recognize the necessity of a reasoned, eclectical approach to the issue of the text. And so it is problematic. I would highly recommend that amongst the elders there be a unanimity of opinion. Now, if you're in a situation where that unanimity is already non-existent, it's a tough situation. Obviously I can get along with fellow believers that just for whatever reason are absolutely convinced they need to use the King James or the TR, whatever else, up to a point. But once we get into defending the flock against the unbelieving attacks coming from the outside, we need to be on the same page, and you're not going to be on the same page as far as what text you're even defending. So wisdom would be that when choosing elders and things like that, be aware of this, have thought it through, think it through. There may be people say, hey, I take a different position, but I'm willing to go along, and I'm not going to raise a stink about it. And I'm not going to start having a home Bible study about why the rest of the elders are wrong about this. I mean, sadly, I'm well aware of how many churches have come apart over stuff like that. So if you find yourself as a member in a church where this starts being presented, then the question you have to ask is it being presented as the consistent understanding of the entire elder body? Is the elder body divided on this? Are they willing to give and able to give pastoral direction as to how to handle these things? Are they aware of the fact that, you know, either direction you go, if, for example, you get to the end of an exposition of Mark and you do not preach through verses 9 through 20, no matter what, you're going to have to explain why. You can't just go, and we're done. And everybody with the King James or New King James is going, or even other modern translations that still have the brackets, they're going to be wondering why it's there. And of course, they'd be wondering, should we really be picking up serpents and drinking poison? And is this really a sign of those who follow me? And this sort of seems a little weird and stuff like that. So you can't just finish verse 8 and then walk off to, you know, whatever book you're going to do next. Or you're going through John, the Pericope Adulteri. If you're a member of a church, then you have to determine just, you know, how far can you bend? How many weeks can you, if you're convinced this is not scripture, are you willing to just take it for a while? And because it's going to move on. Because here's the issue. The TR and the NA 27, 28, they teach the same thing. The differences just aren't that great. It's an important issue to address, but it's not a different faith. It's not a different religion. And you would have to really put a tremendous amount of imbalanced emphasis upon the few major differences. And I've already mentioned the Pericope Adulteri, the long writing of Mark. And in this instance, the person had asked that majority text. So if they're majority text, they wouldn't even have the Comma Johannium, 1 John 5, 7. If they are, then they've got a real problem. But is the connection that you have built through the loving service of other believers in this place over the decades, is that not enough to give you patience during a relatively short preaching series on a text that you're convinced isn't actually canon scripture, but you're willing to go, well, we'll, you know, it's just not going to make that much of a difference. To me, it would seem that that would depend upon the application and fervor with which the position is presented. And if the eldership is divided on the issue, my expectation would be that there wouldn't be as much energy invested in promoting a particular perspective, because that would be energy that's dividing the eldership as it is. So my personal counsel would be patience, but I'm well aware of the fact that there are people who turn this into a real crusade. And so I get that. But, you know, this goes along with the common question. I'm asked it all the time. Would you preach John 7:15 through 8:11, Mark 16, 9 through 20 as canon scripture? Would you preach them if you're preaching through Mark and through John? And my answer is always the same. No, I would not. But I also would not ignore their existence. I would minimally in a recorded video, a class, in some context, make available to the members of the church a full explanation of why I do not believe that those lengthy chunks of traditional text were actually written originally within the place where they're found. Most of the churches I've been a part of already got all that stuff and know where I'm coming from, and I don't necessarily have to do a whole sermon about it. But there are a lot of churches where that would be walking on eggshells or landmines, one of the two. I fully understand that. It really would. So there is a lengthy response to one of our former channel rats from long, long ago, who asked that question. In fact, he said he probably had coronavirus 2 weeks ago. So we hope that he will continue his recovery, just as we hope that Boris Johnson will recover as well. England does not need England does not need to have that happen to them. You know, I saw some report. It was obviously premature and an error, but someone had posted something concerning the Queen testing positive as well. And I'm like, that would be really, really rough. That would be she's, I think, 96 or something like that, somewhere around there. Just probably the classiest lady running around out there, not currently running around anywhere, actually. Most people in England aren't, but there's a wonderful lady. As a full-blooded Yank, I'm still going to mourn definitely at her passing. And again, listening to her Christmas devotionals, I think she's a believer, and at least I hope so. She gives very good reason for thinking that she is. So anyway. Dignity, yes, very, very dignified. Very, very dignified. Someone that you just have a tremendous amount of respect for. Okay. All right, with that, let's get back to what we've been doing. Well, we've sort of been doing it on and off, obviously, because I realize this is a technical area of study, but I think it's a very important area of study. If you love church history and theology, this is your stuff. This is your thing. And if you go, well, yeah, but this isn't my real interest in this area or this particular perspective. Yeah, but one of the things I was mentioning to Rich right before he came on the air is, yeah, I've got all sorts of stuff sitting here going all sorts of different directions, but I love doing this kind of stuff. And at the very least, I feel like my knowledge is expanding, and I'm shoring up areas of study in church history and seeing, you know, connections and stuff. It's great. That's a good positive element to all of this, even in the midst of the controversy. It's a good positive element. And so when I probably next time around, well, once we get this thing done, and I'm pointing at my computer screen, you have no idea why I'm pointing at this computer screen. Once we get the 2018 interview between Leighton Flowers and Ken Wilson done, then we'll do something on Manichaeism. I started putting together a keynote presentation last night. I don't know if I'm going to keep pressing on with that. It is, I don't even know how to explain it. Honestly, I've looked at, you know, there's an excellent article here in Fitzgerald's Augustine Through the Ages, an encyclopedia, this book right here. Like I said, I was reading through this work, Manny and Manichaeism, last night. I've gotten all sorts of stuff online as well as audio stuff that I've listened to while running and riding and stuff like that. And what I'm discovering is there's a fair amount of agreement. You know, it's obviously a little bit of an emphasis here, emphasis there, but there's a fair amount of agreement from modern writers as to what Manichaeism would have been in the days of Augustine, which is what we are concerned about here. And if you're wondering why we are saying that, let me once again remind you of, I've read this statement each of the last three programs, but this will give you, because it's, I consider it an excellent summary statement. From Ken Wilson, the famous Reformed theologian Benjamin Warfield commented, "The Reformation, inwardly considered, was just the ultimate triumph of Augustine's doctrine of grace, period." That really should be a dot, 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 because that's not what he said. Was just the ultimate triumph of Augustine's doctrine of grace over Augustine's doctrine of the church. Warfield's statement is pinpoint accurate, but unfortunately, due to Luther's and Calvin's reliance upon Augustine, the unmerited grace of the Christian God did not triumph. In Augustinian Calvinism Reformed theology, it was the radicalized grace of the Manichaean God that triumphed. So we have to understand, was there even such a thing as a Manichaean God? I would argue there wasn't. There is a principle, but to even use this without making the appropriate differentiations, because Manichaeism is a completely, fundamentally different religious concept. It is a dualistic, Gnostic amalgamation of heretical Christian concepts with Zoroastrianism and Buddhism all mixed in together with Iranian Indo religious concepts, just all sorts of stuff. Almost no seminary graduate really knows what Manichaeism is. Therefore, you can make that kind of a claim, and who's going to catch you on it? There's almost only, well, the people who read this, the dissertation, should have caught this, evidently didn't. The radical difference in what every single word, for example, the radicalized grace of the Manichaean God that triumphed, that's in contrast to Augustine's doctrine of grace. Given the Manichaean concept of deities, many deities, of the realm of light and the realm of darkness, the glorious Father, the fact that... Let me try to explain to you how difficult it is to try to put this into a keynote presentation, okay? If the kids are around, you might want to turn this down for a second. There is a point in the Manichaean... There are three moments in the Manichaean cosmogony. And it's this battle between light and darkness. The darkness sees the light and wants the light and invades the light. And there's a primeval man who goes and fights with the five shields, but he's overcome, but it was actually sort of a trick. And so he sort of invades the realm of darkness, but they take him and they take his light. And so now light is trapped in darkness. And this gets connected together with, like I said, 6-7 different ancient religious concepts, a bunch of astrology. There's a bunch of astrological stuff. So the sun, the moon become spark collection centers for the light that comes out of individuals when they die, because they're being freed from the darkness of the physical body, and they go to the moon or go to the sun. And it depends on what time of the month it is, because as the moon's getting bigger, and then as it gets smaller, there's a lighted path of sparks that are going up into the realm of light, that's easier to see once the moon isn't full. You know what that is? The Milky Way. The Milky Way are sparks which are which we would call souls, that are going up to the realm of light, that have been trapped in the realm of darkness, and that's the Milky Way. No, it's not the rest of our galaxy, which we know it is, but anyway. So you got all this stuff going on, and then at one point, and I'll have to just read it for you directly, but at one point there are these beings, demons, something, and some beings from the realm of light take on such beautiful forms that it sexually arouses these other creatures, and the male creatures spill their seed on the earth. And the female creatures, for some reason, are pregnant, but they're so excited by the male creatures, which are sort of both male and female, that they abort their babies. And these fall down upon the earth, and out of them come other demons that mate, and these two demons mate, and when they mate, what they birth is Adam and Eve. That's where Adam and Eve came from. How do you put that in a keynote? That's what I'm struggling with right now. I mean, because most people just sit there, and it's a little bit like when you do the eternal law progression thing on Mormonism. I never thought I'd study something that would make Mormonism go, oh, okay, space gods from Kolob. Sounds a whole lot more believable than this stuff. But now I have, and it's called Manichaeism. So just with what I just told you, with all the astrology and the different gods and different Jesuses, and the historical Jesus is actually an evil Jesus, and then there's another kind of Jesus, and there's another kind of Jesus over here. And can you see that the term grace of a Manichaean deity is different than the grace of the triune God of Scripture? You think there might be just a smidge of a difference between the two? Yeah, you think so? You think so? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So you may end up learning more about Manichaeism than you ever wanted to know, but it is important. I mean, this was a major religious movement in the Roman Empire starting in the middle of the 3rd century. Well, okay, it took some time. So it started in the middle of the 3rd century, and then it came to the Roman Empire, you know, by the 300s or so. What are you laughing at?
Well, I can just see the conspiracy.
You hit the wrong button. You changed views there.
I did, didn't I? I can just see the conspiracy theories now. Boy, those Calvinists have been hiding a lot more than we ever knew.
That's right. That's right. No two ways about it. No two ways about it. It also has required, and this is extremely helpful, when you hear that we are determinists, what does that mean? And if you're a Calvinist, you tend to just go, well, yeah, God decrees. I mean, Ephesians 1:11, that's what it says. That's worked out in Acts 2, Acts 4, Isaiah 10, Genesis 50, all over the place. This is a biblical teaching. Yeah, okay. But what I've been forced to do is to expand my understanding of the categories of what determinism means. Because, for example, the provisionists argue that the Manichaeans were determinists, and that's where Augustine got it, and then that's where Calvin got it, and that's why you and me. The Bible has nothing to do with what we believe. See, you need to understand that. We just said, as long as Augustine says it, I believe it. Most Calvinists I know have read a few paragraphs of Augustine, may have read the Confessions, haven't read anything he wrote against Julian or the Manichaean movement, or no idea. But that's what we're being told now, is it's just straight line, unmodified, boom, 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 which of course is absurd on its face. But anyway, that's what we're being told about this stuff. The fact is, there's all sorts of different kinds of determinism. all sorts of different kinds of determinism. I had one here. Yeah. Just in general categories, logical determinism, theological determinism, psychological determinism, and physical determinism. But each one of those has all sorts of different elements to it. So under theological determinism, someone who believes that God has knowledge of future events is included as a theological determinist because the outcome is already known to God. Therefore, it can't be changed. That's what open theism is trying to avoid, is that exact thing. And so the funny thing is, to remain a Southern Baptist, Leighton Flowers has to be a theological determinist. Not sure if he's ready to start buying into Manichaeism yet or just what, but we'll send him the starter kit. But there's other forms of determinism. And Stoic determinism is not theological determinism in parallel to the Christian concept at all. Neither is Manichaean. There is no deity in the Manichaean universe, not even really universe, but in the Manichaean concept that has a divine decree of self-revelation, self-glorification. There is no concept of time as being created by God, the fabric of time being created by God. There is, again, there's no personal deity in Manichaeism that would be parallel to the monotheistic concept of the one creator of all things, the ground of all being. At best, you have two equal deities, the light and the darkness. But they're not personal beings with a personal name and revelation and so on and so forth. So the whole idea that the Manichaean God even has the attributes to be able to have a divine decree of self-revelation so as to accomplish without failure the redemption of a particular people in Christ, just not there. It's ridiculous. To draw that kind of parallel and say that Calvin's God and Luther's God is the Manichaean God, that's what you're being told. That is so radical that it's astonishing. And it's so full of holes that I'll tell you right now, once we get done with all this, and once these other folks put out their stuff, we're going to be the ones going, so what happened to that debate challenge? Because it ain't going to happen. I already have hours worth of errors in the dissertation. Okay, so something tells me once we put that all out there and you can go check these sources and you can look these things up and go, huh, yeah, that is what that says. Huh, wonder why it says differently in there. That all of a sudden there's going to be a reason why, you know, we don't want to. Yeah, look at the time. I got to go. Got to floss my cat. That's just not going to happen. But it would be interesting. So anyway, what in the world are we doing here? Oh, I'm just putting this stuff back up here so that because some of these clips, whether I get to them today or not, some of these clips I have some counterexamples to provide, and we'll see if we remember to do that. So I have the audio plugged in, and we're ready to go, and we've got the speed right, so it doesn't sound like the chipmunks. That's always good. Okay, we're picking up where we left off in the 2018 interview, Leighton Flowers and Ken Wilson.
Did you, in your preparations, did you read through many of these other early church fathers as well?
I did. I have many chapters in my dissertation discussing their views, all talking about original sin, about freedom of will. And the earliest Christians, those guys you just mentioned, Irenaeus and Tertullian and Clement, they're all arguing against Stoics and against Manichaeans and Gnostics. They're saying, no, the Christian God is a relational God. He He, in his foreknowledge, knows who's going to respond and who's not. It's not just this arbitrary thing that happens like the Stoics believe and like the Gnostics believe and like the Manichaeans believe.
Now, you see how you put them all together? No serious scholar would ever do that. No serious scholar who wants to be honest with what Stoicism believed, what which group of Gnostics, there are so many different groups of Gnostics with so many different perspectives. Manichaean understanding certainly has the elements of Gnostic dualism within it, but it has all sorts of other stuff. I mean, it borrows from the Indo-Iranian concept of the light and darkness as twins that were given birth at some point in time. And again, even within the Manichaean sources, you have a fragment of something over here and a fragment over there. And does this represent this over here? There is no care demonstrated by Ken Wilson in how he says these things. And it's the same thing in the dissertation, too. It's just thrown out there as if, yeah, they all said the same thing. And we're going to see this. There's a section coming a little bit later on where it says, oh, yeah, nobody before Augustine, everybody believed the same thing. And that's just, it's just fallacious on a level that's hard to comprehend. I mean, there are entire books documenting the different perspectives that were taken and the reality that on some of these issues, no one had written full dissertations yet. And so our information is partial. And so careful scholarship goes, well, that's a good question. Here's some of the things to consider. Limitation of information we have, this, that. The fact that many of these things are written in response to something like this. And so you've got to be careful not to jump to a conclusion that because they respond to this objection in that way that they would necessarily make the application you would make today. That's what careful scholarship does. That's what people who want to accurately represent what came before. And you know why this is maybe resonating with me a little bit more? Is the years I was debating Roman Catholic apologists on church history when Ken Wilson was doing his first study at Golden Gate. Actually, I was teaching at Golden Gate when he was doing that. And so I've seen what happens. I've seen when people try, the Roman Catholic is very often forced to find things in the early church because Rome's dogma says this is what's always been believed. So when you encounter stuff that's different than that, what do you got to do? Well, you got to play with the sources. You got to make the dogmatic stuff work. So I've seen all this before, and I have decades, literally decades, of evidence, 25 years of my saying, let the early church fathers be the early church fathers. They weren't Baptists. They weren't Roman Catholics. They were who they were. Let them be who they were. Read them in their own context. Don't try to turn them into some unified body that you can then use as a club to beat somebody else over the head. I've seen this before. I've seen this before. And Rome does it a lot better than Ken Wilson does. But I've seen this. I'm going to unify everybody together. I'm going to forget all their differences. I'm going to ignore a lot of sources in the process and a lot of places where people said faith is a gift from God. Blah, 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 blah. Don't worry about any of that stuff. Unified body, make up a theological bat and whack you over the head with it. Knowing that, well, remember when we first started, why did our entrance, Alpha and Omega Ministries' entrance into the debating scene with the Roman Catholic Church in the United States make such a huge splash, such a huge difference? So the problem is I can't turn the audio off without turning the audio off. Why did it make such a huge difference? It made such a huge difference. Oh, I know how to fix that. Think. It made such a huge difference because we did not back off of church history. We went toe to toe. And all you got to do is watch what happened in Denver in 1993 with Jerry Mattetix on the subject of papacy. Yeah, you got to listen. You can't watch. Yeah. And you'll see exactly what we mean. And actually, it was before then. It was when we debated Jerry on the infallibility of the Pope at City of the Lord in Tempe, Arizona. That's when the wheels started wobbling and coming off that particular car. So, been there, done that, got the T-shirt. we've been consistent on this all along, and I think that's important. Yes.
Well, wasn't there an exchange with you and was it Scott Hahn in This Rock?
No, that was
Burden. Wasn't that?
No, that was Patrick Madrid.
Pat Madrid.
Uh huh.
So wasn't. What am I remembering here?
That White Man's Burden was the thing about trying to a single quote from Athanasius that I pointed out that Athanasius did not function as a modern Roman Catholic would, and that he stood against councils and bishops of Rome and was proved to be true, to be accurate. And so, yeah, that ended up in a very lengthy exchange between the two of us. Yes,
and I remember you making in the response, which is on our website.
Yep.
That very point that you just made, what? So now, 25 years ago.
That was 93. So, yeah. It was, yeah.
27 years ago.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, we've been consistent on this for a long time. Been consistent on this for a long time. Okay, back to the quote.
It's not just this arbitrary thing that happens like the Stoics believe and like the Gnostics believe and like the Manichaeans believe. So they're fighting the very thing that Augustine ended up putting out there is the truth.
Okay, that's not what Augustine taught. I'm sorry. This is just the there is a term that he writes it out, but in the smaller book he abbreviates it for good reason, which he himself says he coined. Okay, it's Duped, D-U-P-I-E-D, duped. And so in the book, he abbreviates it because it takes up pretty much an entire line of text. Here's what duped stands for. Divine unilateral predetermination of individuals' eternal destinies. Okay, so duped is divine unilateral predetermination of individuals' eternal destinies. Now, Dr. Wilson believes this is what we believe. When you hear that, do you recognize what the fundamental problem is from the start? Any fair reading of... Let's talk about a classic on the attributes and existence of God, and hence will give us grounds for looking at God's eternal decree. Stephen Charnock. If you look at Charnock, if you look at Warfield, if you look at Turretin, and you look at what they wrote concerning God's divine decree, will you define it first and foremost in regards to creatures, because that's what that does. That defines God's decree in regards to what? The eternal destinies of creatures. Has nothing to do with God's eternal decree to glorify himself. Even duped is man-centered. Provisionism, man-centered from the start. That's its essence. That's its goal. That's its heartbeat is man-centeredism. God is always on the outside. So even the definition is man-centered. Eternal destinies. But why would eternal destinies be determined? Well, are you saying that the Reformed understanding of that is the same as a Stoic, a non-Manichaean Gnostic, a Manichaean? You will find differences between each one of those, because the Stoic doesn't have an all-encompassing God. He has a naturalistic determinism. Laws are followed by nature, and those natural cause and effect. So what will be will be. But it's not because there is a purpose. It's because that's the way creation is. Neither the Gnostic nor the Manichaean system has an overarching deity who is eternal, self-existing, creator and sustainer of all things. So immediately on a basic, this is what's so shocking to me, is that this is a man who's teaching in a seminary. On a basic theological level, there cannot be any meaningful parallel drawn. There can't be. You don't have a God to have a decree in these systems. So the decree that you will find in Reformed writers, the theology of God, is rooted in the monotheistic creator of all things and his desire to self-glorify himself in and through creation itself and the redemption of a particular people through the incarnation, through the person of Christ Jesus. As it turns out in Christianity, obviously, that's his intention. That is completely different than naturalistic determinism that says cause and effect, just the way it's going to be. Amongst the Manichaeans, you have differing groups. Many had the elect, and immediately, of course, that becomes, see, there you go, there's the elect. But the elect amongst the Manichaeans were a particular group who made a particular commitment to live by certain ascetic values. And you know what one of their primary religious duties and accomplishments as the elect was due to the Manichaean worldview? Producing excrement. Yeah. So they had very strict dietary laws, and there were certain aspects of food that by eating certain things, they were purifying the world by going poo-poo. And this is paralleled with the elect. I didn't make it up. The seat just collapsed. Bye-bye. Even the seat was embarrassed by what I just had to say. If you can't tell the difference between people who are made in the image of God, who are justly condemned by God for their sin, who suppress the knowledge of God, who are chosen not because of anything in themselves. The elect in Manichaeanism contain the spark, you see. That spark wants to go back to the realm of light. The realm of light wants it. There's something about the elect that draws them. They are special. There's nothing about the elect in Scripture that draws God's love. It is unconditional. It is based upon what? What is the continued, what's the repeated statement? His grace, not anything in and of themselves. His grace alone. You're going to compare that with the Manichaean elect, who help purify the earth by digestion. Okay. There you go. Sorry. yeah. Okay. I'm not going to get very far today because... anyway.
Putting out there is the truth.
Right.
That's not a coincidence.
That's not a coincidence, yeah. It's totally meaningless once you actually know something about the background.
So you have this guy who's really known as a heretic fighter.
Okay, we're talking about Augustine here, and what Leighton has asked is, well, how come he got away with this? Like, the thesis here is that no one had ever believed anything like this before. So, and later on, and I'm just waiting to get to this one. Later on, and I think this is what I'd started to mention to you. Leighton makes a comment about something I had said during our debate, because he quoted from Clement of Rome. And I pointed out that Clement of Rome actually taught much from Pauline doctrine and Pauline letters on the subject of the elect, an election. And he objected to this. And he uses Wilson. Wilson is the scholar of this movement. That's why they're so invested in this. They needed to have somebody because they didn't have anybody before. And so now they've got this. So they're invested in this. They better start checking around and looking around because, yeah. Anyway, and so he says, I had this problem with James White. He mentions Clement. Mentions the elect as if that makes him a Calvinist. And I'm just sitting here going, wow, the way that patristic sources are used by Wilson, you got no room making that objection, A. B, and I guarantee you one thing, Leighton Flowers. You've never read Clement's letter in Greek. You've never taught it at Golden Gate Baptist Theological Seminary in development of patristic theology from the original language. Have you? Guarantee you, you have not. You have no earthly idea of what you're talking about. But you'll accept what somebody else has to say without checking their sources. Okay. All right. Well, there you go.
So you have this guy who's really known as a heretic fighter. Well, when he brings in something that's not quite right, people still respect him. Even Jerome did not agree with Augustine. So as he gets a little pushback, even the Pope did not agree with him that at infant baptism is salvific when you dump it in the put the baby in the water. He doesn't agree with that, and they're damned if you don't.
Now, again, I have received literally at least 150 pages, graphics, pictures of sources from the friend that I mentioned earlier on the subject of baptism in the early church. And I don't want to use all his stuff. I want him to be able to use his stuff. But did you just hear this? Even the Pope didn't believe. Well, which Pope are we talking about? Because there were a couple popes, obviously, many popes during Augustine's life. And I'm intimately familiar with the North African response to Zosimus and to Pelagius' rehabilitation, because that's where the Rome has spoken, the case is closed stuff comes from, that we had to deal with, again, with subject to Roman Catholicism back in the 90s. Leighton's going to bring up Eastern Orthodoxy. And basically, he's going to say, yeah, the Eastern Orthodox, they didn't have Augustine's. They didn't believe any of this stuff. And so, therefore, as a result of that, they're just believing what was believed from the beginning in the first 300 years. So why aren't you Eastern Orthodox? I'm wondering, why aren't you? Maybe that's where this is going. Yeah, could be. Could go down the Hank Road. It very well could be. I don't know. I don't know. But there you go.
I'm writing a book right now on God's sovereignty, looking at the historical impact all the way from Augustine, even before then, all the way up through the modern period and how that happened and what we're viewing.
That's going to be interesting. That's going to be really interesting. Okay. We'll be looking forward to that one.
But the Catholic Church, even to this day, does not readily admit that Augustine taught double predestination, which he does three or four times in his writings. They won't recognize that because they go to his earlier writings and say, well, look, he believed in free will. Well, yeah, he did back then, but in his later writings, he thinks it's worthless. He right. even says, I tried to save free will, but God's grace triumphed.
He did specifically say that. But what I need to know, please, is what is the Catholic Church to which you refer? How does the Catholic Church has the Catholic Church actually made an official pronouncement on Augustine's perspective on these things? And who made it? Because I know all sorts of Roman Catholic scholars who will honestly admit to pretty much everything that was said by Augustine and the differing perspectives of Augustine and the whole nine yards. So how does the Roman Catholic Church figure in here? How does that work? I'd like to know, because, you know, people would say, well, Rome says this and Rome says that and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But I wonder who that actually would refer to. You have to be careful about saying, well, Rome says this and Rome says that.
I mean, at the very end of my book, I list all the scriptures used by Manichaeans to support their doctrine. And guess which ones they are? They're the very ones that Calvinists use today. Is that a coincidence? No.
Okay. Now, I want to, everyone, if you've tuned out, tune back in. Because this kind of reasoning is so flawed that you need to understand why it is flawed. I've been looking for it. I haven't found it yet, but I'm not going to say it's not there yet. But given that the Manichaeans had other scriptures, given that the Manichaeans rejected the prophets and Moses, given that the Manichaeans rejected a number of the Gospels, and hence had an extremely limited biblical canon, plus the revelations of many, plus other books from other religions. I'm wondering, I'm really looking forward to finding in here, I haven't found it yet, but I'm going to keep looking, the hermeneutical methodology that allows you to make a statement like what was just made there. Because what underlies that statement? Well, look at the verses they used. And they used them to support Manichaeism. Really, what verses do you think you could pull out of Paul to substantiate the idea that we are sparks of the realm of light trapped in dark bodies that were actually created by demons that made it and made Adam and Eve? Where exactly do you think you get that from Paul? In fact, how do you interpret Paul without the prophets? How do you do that? He's constantly quoting from the Old Testament. He's constantly quoting from the Psalter, from Moses, from the prophets. And if you've rejected those as revelations of an evil God, then could you please tell me how any person who is trying to deal honestly with the historical context of these writings could come up with the idea that, well, hey, the Manichaeans use these verses, and the Calvinists use these verses, so must be the same thing. They used the same exegetical methodology. They used a grammatical, historical perspective, pan-canonical. They took the entire canon of Scripture. They rejected the vast majority of the canon of Scripture. They limited it to just Tota Scriptura, just the Christian canon? No, they didn't. In fact, they had a completely different canon of Scripture. They believed that scriptures were inspired. No, actually, they didn't. Manny's stuff was, but the Christian scriptures had obviously been manipulated and changed, and you got to pick and choose what you want, even in Paul, because Paul says things about the Jews and things like that, and about the Creator God, and we know that the Creator God's evil, so that can't be. So why have a list like that? What is that supposed to communicate? It sounds good to someone who has zero understanding of logic or history. If that's what you're trying to do is impress that kind of person, okay. But to anyone who does any meaningful study of interreligious studies, interfaith encounters, any type of missionary work, apologetics, studies, any church history, you're just left going, did you just say that in public? Did you just say to everybody that if you use the same verses? I was reminded the first time I heard this while I was running and listening to this, I was reminded of the argument that was used 21 years ago when I had one of my few opportunities to engage a well-known leading figure in the Oneness Pentecostal movement, Dr. Saban. You call that in 1999. I was only 2 years away at that point from finally just giving up. So I still had stuff up here, but it was pathetic. Anyway, we did a debate on the Trinity. And if you've watched that debate or listened to that debate, you are aware of the fact that one of the arguments that Dr. Saban used was that the verses that James White has used to prove the Trinity are the verses Roman Catholicism uses to prove the Trinity. We know that Roman Catholicism is the whore of Babylon. Roman Catholicism murdered all these people. But this man's using the same verses. Now, why do you think he was doing that? Well, I would argue it's because he did not have a meaningful exegetical response to what I presented, and he didn't. And what the later Roman Catholic Church did is irrelevant to the truth content of the prologue of John, John chapter 17, specifically verse 5, and to the Carmen Christi in Philippians chapter 2, all three of which present Jesus as a divine person in communion with the Father prior to his incarnation, which is a refutation of the oneness denial of the Trinity. Why was he doing that? And who would be impacted by that kind of argumentation? It is a false form of argumentation. It's irrelevant to the substance of the argument. But what you're saying is somebody else makes an argument like that and they're bad. So he's bad. So ignore the argument. There's a whole appendix. Well, excuse me, but if you're going to be having discussions about the stuff that's in Romans 8, 9, and 10, what other verses are you going to go to? I don't understand. How is that even relevant? It's the same ones. Same interpretation? No, it's totally different form of, it has to be a completely different form of determinism. It can't be the same form because there's no God in Manichaeism that could be the foundation of the decree that includes the creation of the world. Remember, for the Manichees, demons mated and made Adam and Eve. Didn't make it up. But how can you, for a second, suggest that, well, they just used the same verses and meant something completely different by it? So I guess it would be a valid argument for me to point out that for your provisionism, I can go to the LDS website and the Ensign magazine and show you Joseph Smith and the Mormons using your verses. And they actually use it the same way you do. Right? So that means you all are actually crypto-Mormons. Ready? If Layton starts wearing a name badge and calls himself Elder Flowers, I can just see that coming up on, yeah, and he needs to have the temple garment on underneath too. Or it's just fake at that point. The problem is, I could then give you the sure sign of the nail, but you don't know what the sure sign of the nail is. So there you go. Okay. It's a handshake. Yeah, it's one of the signs in the temple. It's one of the signs. I think it's the Melchizedek priesthood. Anyway, that's right. That's why they closed the temples. Is you can't have the 5 points of fellowship during the coronavirus. No, not happening. We're skipping out on that one. Yeah, big time. Wow. How did we get here? I don't know how we got here. I've lost the point where I was. The point is, obviously, this is fallacious argumentation to the extreme. And I would invite you provisionists who recognize, well, okay, yeah, you could find Mormons using the same verses we use to sort of make the same point. It doesn't invalidate the point just because the Mormons are arguing it. They don't even believe in one true God. Exactly. Will you? Which one of you provisionists is going to come out and say, you know what? I'm not sure about all the rest of this stuff, but yeah, that's a bad argument. Because it is. It's just a bad argument. It's indefensible. And if you'll defend it, then you'll defend anything this man says. It doesn't matter. You don't care. There's no standard here. There's no standard here. So, yeah. All right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did he? 13 minutes. Okay.
And every person who is a determinist quotes Augustine, right? They all get it from Augustine.
Okay. So we have no definition of determinism. We do not have a distinction between mechanical determinism, logical determinism, psychological determinism, physical determinism, theological determinism. We have no distinctions, no recognition. And I'm not going to say this based upon extensive reading of Augustine, but I'm quite certain that the clarity of formulation in regards to the divine decree in Calvin is greater than that in Augustine. And then I think that even gets greater in the next century, so that you have tremendous clarity within Turton. And by the time you get to that point, there, anybody who can confuse the dualistic, naturalistic, non-decretal, no monotheistic God determinism of Manichaeism with that of Reformed theology is just not functioning with the full deck. That's just dishonest. It's just dishonest in its extreme. That's just as clear as you could possibly make it. And so, and all through this, I'm just sitting back going, so not one of us has ever read a verse of the Bible, huh? It's just all that stuff, not just in Ephesians and Romans, but man, I mean, Isaiah 40 through 48, you know, the certainty of the coming of Cyrus. How do you make that work? I mean, Cyrus was the result of literally hundreds of thousands of free choices of creatures. How did God know without a decree? Centuries before the soldiers decided, hey, let's not rip that that seamless garment he's got. Let's get some money. Let's cast lots for it. Hundreds of years. Millions of free will choices. God's a pretty good guesser, huh? Yeah, well, there you go.
And Dr. Wilson, you correct me if this is not correct, but it seems to me that what compatibilists are saying is that men are free as long as they do what they want. But what they want is determined by their nature, which is determined from birth by God's decree.
Yeah.
And that's what Augustine, in your estimation, taught. In other words, they're born with this fallen nature. That's what you have the babies, you know, corrupted.
Okay, now let's make sure we see what the connection here is. In Manichaeism, you are born with a corrupted nature because you're born. Period. There's no federal headship. Adam is the first man who is the offspring of demons. But your connectedness to Adam is that you have a spark of light contained in you that is not natural to this realm and needs to go back to the light realm. That's not federal headship. That's not covenant theology. That's not based upon a monotheistic worldview. You don't have a creator. How do you make these parallels? Why do you ignore these fundamental contextual facts that change everything? How is this done? I am stunned when I listen to this stuff. How can you ignore this stuff? Are you really going to sit there and say, it doesn't matter? Doesn't matter. That doesn't, nope, nope. We're using the same terminology, but
yeah. And that's what Augustine, in your estimation, taught. In other words, they're born with this fallen nature. That's what you have the babies, you know, corrupted with this guilt, and they are going to be God haters from birth because that's their nature, unless God steps in and changes their nature to make them want God.
Yes.
Is that oversimplifying it?
I think that's exactly right. That's a very easy, simple way to explain it. That's true.
Exactly. So when God's chalk in 800 taught it, though, because he wasn't the famous, you know, Augustine, you know, the fighter, he was deemed a heretic.
I'm not sure how much about Gottschalk Leighton Flowers actually knows. Leighton, honestly, without Googling, do you know who Ribertus and Retrianus were? If you don't, stop talking about Gottschalk, because you don't know what you're talking about. You're just...
Yeah. And so when you appeal to history as an authority, then it's really depending on which council you want to appeal to. You know, you appeal to the Council of Orange or the Council of Dort or the Council of Nicaea or this council, that council, which is one of the reasons that we do want to appeal, obviously, to Scripture as our first and foremost authority.
You guys get to do that. We don't. So you didn't challenge him when he said that every determinist just gets it from Augustine. But now we want to appeal to you want to get to appeal to Scripture? Like we don't? You know, you and I should debate Romans. Oh, never mind. We already did.
Because no matter what view you hold to, you can find some council somewhere that probably supported whatever weird view you want to support.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're both chuckling, but that's exactly what this is all about. You decide you're going to come up with a way of cramming Southern Baptist traditionalism into the early church. And so, yeah, you can find a quote here, a quote there, interpret it in your context, and boom, 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 you got it. Yep. Especially the early church is liable to a tremendous amount of that kind of let's cram our thinking into these guys. Yeah, you're right. Leighton, that's exactly what y'all are up to.
The early church fathers prior to Augustine were confused about this issue and didn't know what they're talking about and obviously didn't get it right. So Augustine was kind of the first, I think it's Lorraine Botner or Bettner, however you pronounce that, who's also a Calvinistic historian who admits that Augustine is the first to introduce these things.
Lorraine Botner. Okay. Yeah, it's Bettner. At least Dr. Wilson knew that. I think that's what he was saying in the background. But again, this is a super simplified, simplistic way of approaching it. What has been said was the early centuries up to this point in time were focused upon what? Doctrine of God and Christology. Doctrine of God and Christology. What were the councils about? What was Nicaea about? What was Ephesus about? Why was there the Arian resurgence? Why do you have Athanasius kicked out of his... Why was Athanasius kicked out of his church five times while the Roman soldiers were running in the front door and he's running out the back? Did it have to do with soteriology? No, it didn't. It had to do with the doctrine of God, the doctrine of Christ, the doctrine of the Trinity. What about Chalcedon? What about Ephesus? Why were the monks beating the snot out of each other at Ephesus? It wasn't about this. So there was a shift at this point in time to a new discussion. And you can pretend that, well, when they were arguing with the pagans, they said this, and therefore I'm going to assume that that meant this. You can do that if you want, but again, you're just not accurately representing what was going on in history.
Was there any other debating among the church fathers, like between Polycarp and Irenaeus or Ignatius? And
we have almost nothing Polycarp ever said, Leighton. It's all secondary sources.
And other notable recognized church fathers that may have said, okay, hey, wait, look at Romans 9, guys. This is obviously teaching something about God, you know, sovereignty over our choices. Is there any evidence of any of those types of people prior to Augustine that you're aware of?
Okay, now, what should a meaningful scholar say at this point? A meaningful, fair, balanced scholar is going to say, well, there is a lot we don't have. There are entire books that people wrote that we do not possess. For many of the early fathers, we can only answer that question in light of what somebody else said that they said. But in light of that, then we can see multiple different perspectives. We can contrast Clement of Rome with the Epistle of Barnabas and the Shepherd of Hermas. They're roughly contemporaneous. I think Clement's a good bit earlier, but within 100 years, obviously. And then we have, for example, from Ignatius, we can glean certain things, but he's writing epistles as he's going to die. He's not writing a systematic theology. So there's going to be imbalance even in what we have. And so there is, especially as Greek philosophy takes more and more of an important role, there's going to be a lot of emphasis upon the discussions that the Greeks were having concerning the nature of man. And, you know, then we could get into Justin, and he doesn't have the complete canon. And see, that's what someone who wants to teach history rather than use history, that's how they're going to respond. Let's see what the response was.
Not in the Christian circles. Everybody teaches the same thing, which is what I point out in my Oxford thesis. Where in Christianity does everybody agree? I mean, that just doesn't happen. That's phenomenal that everybody can agree.
For almost 400 years.
Yes. I mean, it's like they all view a general sovereignty of God, like a king controlling a country. He doesn't micromanage everybody's, you know, lives. He's there. And it's not until, and they're fighting the dictatorial micromanagement view of Stoicism, Manichaeanism, and Gnosticism.
Okay. Now, have we repeated enough now that you're starting to recognize the theme here? This may get a little old. Sorry. But to draw the parallel, and without the parallel, all this stuff disappears. It becomes irrelevant. It becomes an argument about whether Augustine went back and edited a couple of books later in his life, which no one actually argues or could care one way or the other. But you hear what's being done now? So you take the Stoics, you take the Gnostics, and you take the Manichaeans. Differences between each one. Big, important differences as to what determinism would mean to them. None of them have a monotheistic God who is sufficient ground for a meaningful decree of self-glorification. But what you want to do is you want to plant in the mind the idea they were teaching the same thing. Augustine went back, picked it up. That's where it came from. No one had ever dreamed of this. Don't worry about what anybody said before this. Don't read anything that Clement said. Don't read the Epistle to Dionysius. You don't look. No, don't. They were all on the same page. They were Southern Baptist provisionists. That's what they were. Just believe me. I went to Oxford. I know. I read it all. See? And we're supposed to go. So this massive difference in what the decree would even look like, what it'd be based upon, what it could be. We're just supposed to go, don't have to worry about that. Yeah, basically. That's what we're being told.
So for all these years, they're saying the same thing until you hit Augustine. There is no debate. And that's commonly known. I mean, the encyclopedias and the big guys who write those point that out, that there was no conflict between human free will and divine sovereignty until Augustine. That's when it started.
So there is your... there's your super simplistic assertion. Your super simplistic assertion. It only started then. Historically, you had discussions of the nature of the will prior to this, where there were disagreements. How do I know this? Because I've studied church history. But it was primarily in reference to the human will of Jesus, because the focus and the energy was on Christology. So Nestorianism, Apollinarianism, Eutychianism, they're all directly relevant. The whole hypostatic union is relevant to anthropology and the nature of the human soul. But an argument on this subject had not come up till this point. There was no debate. That's right. There was no debate. Not because it was something that everybody had already decided on and there was a unanimous position. That's the faux position here. Is that, yeah, we've all discussed that. We're all on the same page. Everybody believed the same thing. And then Augustine came along and turned us all into Manichaeans. No. If you think history works that way, then you need to go read a book called The Trail of Blood, because it's a little bit more along your lines. Sadly, sort of a conspiratorial type thing. All right, I'm going to mark where we are here, because we're almost, yeah, we're almost there. There's not a whole lot more there. So that's, we actually got through a lot today. I am pleased. We are doing many dividing lines, so we will get there as we get there. So save this file so I don't lose all this stuff. And there you go. Sorry, parents, if you left your kids sitting in the room when I had to start describing some of the Manichaean beliefs, but all we Calvinists are secret Manichaeans. Anyways, that's what we've been told by Oxford Scholar. So that's what we are. So. We're just going to sneak it in whenever we can because of something. Anyhow, all right. Now, you got to admit, if you stuck with me this long, for the past hour and 10 minutes, you thought almost nothing about COVID-19. We are here to serve. Got to admit, because I didn't. So there you go. We are here to serve. I hope I can remember. I'm just going to leave all this stuff here because I'll get to it tomorrow. But I've got some stuff about Augustine and Eastern Orthodoxy here. I've got stuff about the Essenes from Qumran. It's Qumran. That's how you say it. And I've got all sorts of neat stuff. And I may have more if I get a chance to roll through stuff. Who knows? We'll see. But thanks for joining us. We will see you. Wait a minute. What's today? Tuesday. We'll see you on Thursday. Oh. Wait. Wait, there's more. Tomorrow, if you want another 2 hours to not think about COVID-19, from 4 to 6 Eastern Daylight Time, Iron Sharpens Iron, Chris Arnzen, we're going to be talking about The Debate on Purgatory with Peter Stravinskas. Chris was there. He introduced it. He didn't moderate it. Having Chris moderate would always have been, that would have been a bad idea at almost any point in time when you think about it. Because the temptation that he would have experienced. I mean, as it was, we had to, you know, like at the baptism debate with Bill Shishko. Yeah, what's that back here? They got themselves a kiddie pool. It wasn't a swimming pool, it was a kiddie pool. And and the Barry Lynn debate would not have even happened if we had been foolish enough to let Chris moderate that one. And he will admit that, won't you, Chris? Yes, you will. You're laughing. I can hear you laughing right now. I can hear it all the way from Pennsylvania because Chris Arnzen's laugh is absolutely epic. But anyway, so maybe he'll tell you on the program tomorrow about how utterly humorless I was when we first met, and how I owe all of my humor, or lack thereof, to Chris Arnzen. But anyways, we're going to talk about the Peter Stravinskas debate and the doctrine of purgatory and and maybe some of the other debates along the way. We'll just see. So that's tomorrow, 4 to 6 p.m., Iron Sharpens Iron. Look it up on the web, mark it, and we'll be on tomorrow. So want to make sure that we got that out there. Thanks a lot for watching today. We'll see you on Thursday. God bless.